Thank you very much. Time is 10:48. We're just 2 minutes before our scheduled time. I just want to check with both counsel to see if there is anybody else that you are waiting for. I don't want to start in, too soon before any parties that might want to be present can be.
My client is here, Your Honor, so I'm happy to start a little early.
Okay.
My client, Your Honor, was aware that he needed to log in early if he wished to be here this morning, so I presume he's done so.
Okay. Thank you very much. Then we will go ahead and proceed. Good morning to everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, April 21st, 2022. We have five cases on our calendar today. Three are set for oral argument. This is the third of the three. This is A21-1016, Melissa Ann Kuchera versus Joel Wayne Biebighauser in County of Dakota. If I mispronounce anybody's name, my sincere apologies. This is being recorded. We are holding this via Zoom. No other recordings are permitted. We appreciate everybody being able to attend via Zoom. And we do realize, however, that we may run into technical issues. If we do, we will make sure that we address them and allow each of the parties the appropriate amount of time to make their arguments. We do have a clock that is there. We have 15 minutes set aside for appellant for initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for appellant for rebuttal, if you so choose. And with that, we will proceed with appellant. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you may proceed.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Hartwell, H-A-R-T-W-E-L-L. I represent the appellant, Melissa Kuchera. And I began representing Ms. Kuchera only during this appeal. The order that Ms. Kuchera is appealing today was issued following a two-day trial in May 2021, at which she represented herself after attorney told her they were unable to do her trial on such short notice. It would be tempting for the court to write this case off as just another instance where a parent merely didn't like the outcome they got in family court and was asking this court to reweigh the evidence. But of course, that's not the standard this court must examine, and that's not what Ms. Kuchera is asking this court to do. Here, the district court's June 2021 order must be reversed as an abuse of discretion because the court's modification of custody for an 11-year-old girl was unsupported by the totality of the evidence. The absence of an attorney for Ms. Kuchera, coupled with the presence of an attorney for Mr. Biebighauser, is striking because the court's order references the parts of the exhibits that were elucidated by Mr. Biebighauser's attorney in testimony, but the court's order is silent on the parts of the exhibits that were not teased out in testimony, which counsel for Ms. Kuchera could and would have been able to do. Unfortunately, she didn't have counsel there. And so while counsel makes an argument in his respondent's brief that she did a good job at trial, she was able to have her own exhibits, she was able to conduct direct and cross-examination. The point of the matter is that an experienced attorney, or really any attorney, would have been able to reference parts of the exhibits that Mr. Haugen himself did on behalf of his client. And Ms. Kuchera didn't have the benefit of that counsel. Since she didn't, the district court had even more of a duty to review all of the exhibits in their entirety and issue findings that were supported by the evidence as a whole. And it is true that the court did issue detailed findings, but the findings, again, are heavily slanted in favor of Mr. Biebighauser, while the evidence that favors Ms. Kuchera, and there was plenty, is not mentioned anywhere in the court's findings. These omissions caused the court to make findings that are not supported by the totality of the evidence.
Ms. Hartwell, is there any case law that requires the district court to list out all the facts, even ones that credibility determinations that this court doesn't believe a particular party or facts that don't support the decision by the district court? That seems kind of counterintuitive.
Certainly. And it would be impossible for the court to list every single, that would essentially be reprinting a transcript of the trial, in essence. The court doesn't have to make detailed findings on every single factor of the 12 best interest factors regarding a child's best interests. They don't have to go through each exhibit line by line and say what about it they found credible or not. But it's striking that there's an absence here of findings that would have helped mother, while the findings that helped father are all listed.
Well, but the discord, it wasn't that the discord didn't have findings favorable to mother. I mean, I think the discord acknowledged that mother cares about child, mother can be a parent to the child, and mother should continue to parent the child. So it wasn't as if it was completely slanted against mother or completely favorable to father. The discord also found that father wasn't always acting in the best interest of the child and wasn't always fulfilling his obligation to support mother as a parent, and found fault, quite frankly, on both sides in terms of not being able to cooperate. So I didn't really see it as being negative to just mother and completely positive to father.
I agree, Your Honor. And it's true that the court did, there on several factors, the court noted both parents' struggles. So for instance, findings 57 to 61 of the order describe that both parents have struggled to support the child's relationship with the other parent. And then the court sort of inexplicably jumps to a statement that this factor supports modification, but doesn't make any description of how the proposed modification would better enable the parents to support the child's relationship with the other. So the court certainly did say negative things about father. It's not that the court was solely in father's camp. But the problem with the order is that the findings are not supported by the evidence and don't describe why the findings support modification. Likewise,
I read the district court's order to be that there's been an imbalance. The fact that mother has more time with child and that mother unilaterally changed the allocation of time, that the district court said, okay, I realize the two of you haven't been getting along and haven't been communicating. This has been going on for several years. But I think a balance between the two, an equal balance, 1 week on, 1 week off, it'll limit the amount of contact between parents. It'll limit the amount of communication between the parents. And that will make things, should hopefully make things go a little better, a little smoother between the two, because it's actually minimizing the contact and the communication between the parents.
Sure. I mean, the problem with the court's order is that it has created new problems. And I, of course, don't want to get too far afield into the things that have elapsed since the court's order in June of last year. But the court did make detailed findings about how problematic it was for the child to be spending a lot of time in the car in between parents' houses and things like that. But then the court went ahead and issued an order that caused the child to be driven quite far to school during mother's time. So the court issued an order requiring the child to be enrolled in school in father's school district. And now she's with mother for 1 week on, 1 week off with each parent, and must spend an inordinate amount of time in the car. So the court said that it was providing solutions, but the court's in order didn't create any solutions. It just sort of shifted things around. This case.
Go ahead and finish your sentence. I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's all right. No, please go ahead.
So I'm looking at the issue about, beyond the continuous one you've talked about, to whether there's evidence to support the existing custodial relationship endangered the child. And you know, looking at your argument, I do have some concerns about the adequate record support for the finding that the mother interfered with the therapeutic relationship. Okay, so I have some questions about that. On the other hand, even if I say, well, maybe there wasn't enough to support that, you know, I think that there is enough clear evidence that the mother did interfere with the father's rights as a joint legal custodian. And certainly the child, you know, did suffer from suicidal ideation when she was in mother's custody. So my question is, if the panel thinks, well, you know, maybe one or maybe a couple of these findings weren't supported, but others were, you know, at what point do we say we need to send this back to have this reexamined, as opposed to just saying, you know, but because some were supported, we're going to affirm. So if you have any cases or, you know, guidance for us on that topic, we would, I would appreciate it.
Sure. The Ross case and the Gaiba case are instructive on that point. The citations are in my brief, but they're both Court of Appeals cases. The Ross case in 1991 makes clear that there has to be a significant degree of danger to constitute endangerment that warrants modification. And the Gaiba case in 1997 discusses the insufficiency of nonspecific allegations, such as a mother verbally berating a child or insulting her, which are what happened here. And those are the basis for father's complaint that the child was endangered in mother's care. The basis for his complaint wasn't necessarily about suicidal ideation. And in fact, the evidence supports the conclusion that father didn't pay enough attention to the child's suicidal ideation. She was seeing a therapist. Mother immediately addressed the issue with the therapist. The therapist didn't have concerns that warranted additional intervention for the child. And the child, the therapy notes make clear that the child has a history of lying and being untruthful and was very angry with her mother and was going through some things, and that the suicidal ideation might not have even been credible or risen to a level where intervention was necessary.
Ms. Hartwell, can I stop you on that? Because when I looked at your reply brief in particular, I was actually very concerned. I understand some of your other arguments and the basis for them, but in your reply brief, you argue that father, quote, continues to undermine and ignore the therapist's treatment plan assessment to support his false narrative that the child was suicidal and was so because of her mother's endangerment. How is her diary entries indicating her suicidal ideations and even suicidal attempts, how is that a false narrative by father? I mean, it seems to me that if suicidal thoughts and attempts are not you know, significant degree of danger to a child, I don't know what is. And I'm having trouble faulting father for at least saying, well, wait a minute. You know, there's some serious issues here that need to be addressed. And I'm really concerned about the safety of my child, of my daughter.
Sure. And the appropriate response to that would have been to get her into some kind of crisis care or to seek intervention. If he felt that the therapist wasn't appropriate for any reason, then at that time, when you feel that your child is suicidal, your duty as a parent is to get them into any kind of crisis care that you can.
Okay, but wait a minute. I mean, we have two parents here. It's not just father. And she was already in therapy.
Right.
And so he reached out to the therapist. He has joint legal custody. So he's entitled to know exactly what is going on with respect to her health. But instead of having access to that information, he was blocked by both the therapist and mother and not getting the information. So I think the district court, you know, expressed some serious concerns about that.
Actually, at that time, he was not blocked. He was having discussions with a therapist and he had access to the therapist. And the evidence is clear that the therapist offered him the phone number to a crisis line or crisis care, and father wasn't interested in taking it. And so the access concern that the court raises actually occurred much later. At the time that the suicidal ideation was noted, father had the same access that mother did, and he didn't take the steps to get emergency care for the child. I agree that that's very serious, but the problem with this case and with this trial is that there wasn't any professional testimony, there weren't any expert witnesses, there wasn't an evaluation of the child's journal and therapy notes to determine whether her suicidal ideation was because of something that had happened in mother's care. We can't just make the conclusion that because a child is writing things in a journal means that the parent whose care she's in at that time is the source of the suicidal thoughts. that's just, that's really scratching the surface. And father didn't offer any expert witness or any professional testimony to support his claim that it was because of mother that the child was suicidal. Nor did father.
Wasn't the basis of that the diary entry itself? The entries indicate that mother is the source of her pain.
Yes, but the therapy notes as a whole also indicate that the child was really angry at mom. And there are a number of reasons why a child might write things in a journal that may or may not be true. And to expect an 11-year-old, I believe she was 9 at the time, a 9-year-old child to be able to elucidate the reasons why she wasn't feeling good is expecting a lot of a child. That's when a therapist must take over and help the child sort out what the sources of her pain are. And that was done by mother. It was not done by father.
Isn't that part of the issue, though? It was done by mother, not father.
But at that time, both parents had equal access to the same therapist, and the therapist tried to bring father in to the conversation and to involve him in crisis care, and he was uninterested. And so mother proceeded with the therapy, and the child is not suicidal, was not demonstrating suicidal thoughts. At the time that the child stopped therapy, the child was doing well and was talking about how she used dancing as a form of stress relief. And that's, certainly an appropriate thing for a child to do who's just exhibiting sort of medium level anxiety that doesn't require crisis suicide care. So for those reasons, we don't believe that the court's order is supported by the evidence, and we ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hartwell. Mr. Hagan, you'll have 15 minutes for your arguments. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Haugen, and I represent respondent Joel Beebehauser in the appeal before you today. At its legal core, well, counsel stated that this is not a normal appeal that you would see in these cases. Respondent's position is that this is exactly a run-of-the-mill custody and parenting time appeal, which cannot be overturned, obviously, absent an abuse of discretion. Here, the district court process included a prima facie stage hearing, extensive motion practice, phone conferences, lengthy discovery, and a 2-day trial. And upon its complete review, which it is presumed to make by this court, the district court crafted a detailed order containing 86 findings within the framework required of custody and parenting time modification decisions. The district court is best positioned to assess the credibility of witnesses in this context and to give proper weight to exhibits and testimony. And it did so here, and the facts in this case and in this order are wholly supported by the record. As it is one of the hearts of appellant's cases, I'd like to address, as well as questions, the continuance issue, endangerment, particularly as it pertains to the child's mental health and appellant's failure to adequately cooperate and address those concerns, and the manner in which the court engaged in the required balancing of harms analysis in reaching its conclusions. First, I want to briefly touch on, though, some of the questioning that was just asked, because I think it's important, particularly the concept that father had equal access to the child's therapy, which is the crux of the endangerment in this case. The child's suicidal ideations were at a time of tremendous upheaval in the child's life. And that upheaval was in mother's care and is supported in findings in the record to be endangering the child's mental, emotional, and physical well-being. It extends well beyond simply the therapeutic relationship or the contents of Exhibit 109. And when these came to a head, father became aware of suicidal ideations and took those incredibly seriously. He became aware of those, as the record shows, in early April in 2020, and he took action to engage the therapist and engage mother and to get the child to an emergency appointment outside of her normal scheduled routine on April 18th of 2020 with her therapist. As father testified, the reason he didn't take intervention information from the therapist, which is not in the therapist notes, is because he already had the phone numbers that were being offered by the therapist. He had already been proactive in doing some of his own research, but attempted to leverage the child's existing therapy relationship first. It was within 2 days, in fact, that the child had a second appointment initiated by mother with that same therapist outside of her normal therapy routine. And it was at that appointment where father was suddenly cut out by the decision of therapist and mother from the child's therapy going forward. The parties then participated in mediation and couldn't resolve the issue. They participated in follow-up discussions, which are all in the record. And at every step of the way, father said, "I am concerned, but I believe this therapist is inadequate to address our daughter's needs, both because you didn't receive my consent as a joint legal custodian, but also because I believe this therapist isn't meeting the child's needs. What are we going to do about it?" He proposed on multiple occasions a new therapist that they could mutually agree upon. And mother, at every step of the way, as the court appropriately found, undermined father's ability to participate by refusing to cooperate with him, by negating his role as a joint legal custodian, and in doing so, keeping father cut out from the child's therapy. And at trial, Your Honors, the child, because of these actions, had been without a therapist for 6 of 10 months of this of the preceding 10 months at the time of trial, despite father's repeated attempts that are all in the record to try to follow professional recommendations to find a jointly agreed therapist so both parents could participate in therapy to address the child's issues. So the concept of equal access is actually not one that was afforded to father in this case. And I think Your Honor was correct that this was an incredible concern to the district court. The district court spent time looking at Exhibit 109 and made clear that it had reviewed Exhibit 109 in full at trial. So while Exhibit 109 may be used to highlight portions that father presented in his case, that does not mean that the district court didn't review the record as a whole. That only means that the district court was compelled and found relevant certain parts of Exhibit 109 that it included in its order. But the endangerment finding extends far beyond Exhibit 109 here, and I think is at the crux of the issue, because the district court references in its order the existing order for protection that mom had between her on behalf of herself and 3 non-joint children and her former significant other. The district court's order references Exhibit 103, which are therapy emails with father attempting to gain information about therapy. It references Exhibit 104, which is about party emails between the parties about therapy and a child in crisis. It references Exhibit 111, which is the child's diagnostic assessment. It references Exhibit 132, which is mother's PTSD diagnosis or supposed PTSD diagnosis. It references Exhibit 128, which is father's mental health records that were submitted. And it references Exhibit 135 and 138, which were certain credibility issues regarding the child's stability relating to mother moving this child multiple times, both in the past and during the pendency of this proceeding, to an additional hour away from father. So she was over 2 hours in total from father and an hour away from her school. So to focus solely on 109 disregards the actual breadth of work that the district court did in reviewing the record and the findings it made upon that record. Additionally, to round out the endangerment issue, is that this is not a case of solely mental health endangerment. Generally, the cases that were referenced, including Gieb, talk about how a single incident is not enough to meet a sufficient degree of danger. And that is something that respondent agrees with, frankly. But in this case, there was not a single incident. There was turmoil in the mother's home. There were mother's attempts to cut off father's parenting time in favor of a former significant other, despite the existence of an order for protection between that significant other and their 3 joint children, showing a disregard for the child's safety in the court's eyes. There was a testimony, there was repeated testimony about the willingness of the parties to engage and meet the needs of the child historically and in this instance. There are claims by the child, if mother finds Exhibit 109 credible, then certainly the district court was reasonable to find credible the claims by the child that she'd been struck by appellant, that she had been belittled by appellant verbally and emotionally, that she had been subject to yelling and screaming and taunts and punishments, and that that reaction, it's not just the existence of them, but it's the impact on the child that the court is always focused on. And here, as Your Honor pointed out, the impact on that environment where mother could not provide stability, could not provide safety, mentally, emotionally, and physically for the child, was all relevant to the court because the impact on that was significant and detailed suicidal ideations. Obviously, Your Honors have referenced it already, but direct references to ropes and guns and knives by a 9-10-year-old child, direct references to attempts to stab herself or hoping she can find a gun, repeated statements over and over again saying, "I want to die. I would rather leave this earth than live with my mother." Those are a significant impact on the child that was all there for the court. And again, the court went well beyond simply Exhibit 109 in examining the situation that was leading to the child being endangered.
Mr. Hogan, if I may, just given our limited time with you, I want to go to the issue of the best interest analysis. Appellant raises just the point that, you know, where the district court on one hand finds that both parties have consistently failed to demonstrate a willingness and ability to cooperate in rearing the child, you know, that awarding joint physical custody just is contrary to that finding and to what, you know, seems clear, at least to me, reading the file in this matter. You know, and we do have cases that, you know, albeit a lot of them are non-presidential cases, that say that you shouldn't be awarding joint custody, you know, where the parties can't cooperate. So, I understand that perhaps from appellants, it's kind of like, be careful what you wish for, right? You know, but that gives me pause. So I'd like you to share your thinking on why joint physical custody is in the best interest of the child given the parties.
Certainly, Your Honor. And that takes us to the analysis as a whole, obviously, that the court engaged in, which is a 4-part analysis under the Nice-Peterson standard. And it lays that out, I think, in clear detail, or at least a clear format for the court to follow what the district court was analyzing. On the best interest factors in particular, admittedly, the court had issues with respondent too. And they've had a long history of litigation and issues between them. And I take Your Honor's point on that. What the district court found in this case, however, which is the district court's role, frankly, is to examine all the evidence and to weigh what is most important to ensure that the best interests of the child overall, not on a certain factor, but overall, is met. And in doing so, the court clearly was concerned with the stability for the minor child, and particular in findings 76 and 77, which I think are key summary findings for the court, is that they speak to the court's concern that the imbalance in custody and the imbalance in parenting time is a significant driver to the litigation from the parties in the past, to the parties' ability to cooperate in rearing their child, and to the child's overall emotional, physical, and mental well-being and development. And that by removing that imbalance, the court didn't give respondent everything he wanted at trial either, because he was looking to flip the schedule entirely. But the court, within its discretion, based on the record, felt that in the best interest of this child, joint physical custody and an equal parenting time schedule removed the imbalance that either parent could leverage based on their history to ensure that the child remained the focus for the parents moving forward. And I think that conclusion summarizes the court's view on the best interests of the child, and also I think shows what was a primary concern for the district court in the finalization of how it viewed the evidence and ultimately the ruling it made. I do want to touch on the continuance issue briefly before my time is up. This issue in whether the denial of a continuance is reversible error, the court at the district court level only grants a continuance for good cause shown. And that discretion is not a de novo review. I want to make that clear. But that discretion sits solely squarely with the trial court. as to if it feels that there's good cause shown and whether they erred in denying or granting a continuance is an abuse of discretion standard. The test ultimately for this court, though, is whether the denial prejudiced the party's outcome at trial. And one of the main things here is that in appellant's brief, two things. The withdrawal of counsel, first and foremost, has been stated by this court on several occasions. That does not create any sort of statutory or constitutional right to counsel in family law matters. So we're not dealing with a situation where there's an overall right to counsel that was ignored. Additionally, the facts that appellant heavily relies on are actually facts that were not in the record to the trial court at the time the continuance was requested. And that's incredibly important because it was a vague request for continuance after 4.5 weeks without an attorney, roughly, after a discovery hearing where the appellant appeared pro se. That transcript is also in the record from that hearing because the court significantly discussed trial procedure and obligations with appellant at that hearing. And appellant's argument is that she purportedly made diligent attempts to find counsel. She had spent over a month looking for counsel, that she had 11 different attorneys say no to her case on short notice. And finally, that her diagnosis of PTSD should have led to a granting of a continuance. Those four things, though, are not what are contained in the appellant's continuance request. They are not actually stated in the record as reason she's requesting a continuance. So they cannot be relied on by this court. Additionally, this is the second time that appellant sought a continuance. While appellant argues it's the first, this same set of factors played out at the prima facie stage. Appellant lost counsel, waited a significant time to find counsel, attempted to obtain counsel supposedly at the 11th hour, and then requested a continuance. Same thing at the trial court, and a child would have continued in crisis had the trial court granted the continuance prejudicing father. And with that, I see my time has run. So unless there's further questions, I rest.
Looks like there are no further questions, Mr. Hogan. Thank you very much. Ms. Hartwell, we'll turn back to you. 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I want to address the issue of the continuance request because it's important for the court to note that the facts that are not in the record, that's part of the problem. The problem is that this appellant didn't have the opportunity to know what she should have put in a continuance request because she didn't have counsel. And it would have been better, of course, for her to have made a much more detailed request and set forth all of the things that she had done to try to get counsel. But the fact that she didn't know to do that just highlights how important it is to have counsel representing you in such a contested manner. I just want to talk about the imbalance that Mr. Haugen addressed with regard to the court's attempt to correct historical imbalance between the parents. The Green Law case that I cited in the brief, which is a Minnesota Court of Appeals case from 1986, really highlights how dangerous it is to give parents who don't get along joint custody because it's likely to increase opportunities for conflict. And that is the essence of this case where creating or trying to correct past wrongs by swinging the pendulum over more toward what the court perceived to be the middle isn't the proper remedy for parents who simply cannot co-parent and cooperate to raise their child. It's punitive toward the child for the court to be trying to make things right for father going forward. And the court's order, in fact, made things, created a situation where the opportunities for conflict persist because the parents are now sharing the child on an equal parenting time schedule. The child has transportation difficulties and has to go to
school. But Ms. Hartwell, I think you're relying on information that's not in the record, correct? In terms of what happened post decision by the district court. Here's where I'm struggling is we give a lot of deference to the district court to try to come up with a solution. And they're hearing the testimony. They're listening to the parties. They're trying to do the best they can in a what oftentimes is a no-win situation, and trying to come up with some type of solution that might work, knowing, especially like in a case like this, that was the past 5, 6, 7 years, nothing has worked up to this point. So why should we be, as an error correcting court, as an appellate court, be second guessing the district court's decision, provided that there's support in the record for it? And the district court does specifically note in finding fact number 76 that the imbalance of power has caused continual conflict and court involvement over the last 7 years. So the court has made very clear as to what, in its opinion, has caused this, and has tried to come up with a solution that may work, may not, but is making its best judgment. Why should we reverse that decision?
Because the court's findings weren't supported by the totality of the evidence that would have given the court other options. I don't have to rely on things that have happened since the court's order. It was foreseeable when the court made its order that an order that required a child to go to school 2 hours away from her primary residence, that has been her primary residence for her entire life, would pose some problems. And I don't have to tell the court what problems.
She would have had to move schools anyway, though, right? I thought the district court found that she would have had to move schools regardless of what happened.
Sure, because she was going to middle school, and there's no reason why she couldn't have gone to middle school in the district where her siblings were going to go with her primary custodian, who had always been her mother. This isn't a case where there had been a lot of litigation about which custodian should be primary. In fact, there was very little litigation. There was quite a bit of conflict, I agree, but very little litigation prior to father bringing his motion. And so the idea that the court had to make findings that would correct all of these other things that had been tried just isn't the case. Nothing else had been tried. And the point that I'm making is that the court's findings aren't supported by evidence that was in the best interest of the child when it made findings that were just impractical to carry out. I see that my time is up. I rest. Thank you.
Thank you both very much for the briefing and the oral argument. Always helpful to hear.